William Manchester is the author of American Caesar, Douglas MacArthur, The Death of the President, The Arms of Krupp, and now a very personal memoir of his experiences in the Second World War. It's called Goodbye Darkness. It's published by Little Brown and Company. And Bill Manchester, you were flying on a Boeing 747 as you opened your book, and then you remembered the first man that you killed. Can you tell me about that?
Well, I had suppressed for many years memories that I could not tolerate, and one reason for going back to the Pacific and revisiting the islands was to see if I could find something of myself that I left there and to retrieve it. And I was on a plane headed out into the Pacific when, after a second martini, I suddenly remembered with a surge of remorse and guilt the man, the first man that I had killed. He was a Japanese sniper who was nested in a fishing shack on Motobu Peninsula on Okinawa, and he was picking off people on the 5th Marines who were on our flank. And I realized from the direction of the fire that he had to be in that shack. And I also realized that there would come a time when he would be weary of seeking targets on that side and shooting at us. So I had a choice, to be quick or to be dead. And I had a .45, and I ran to the shack. I kicked the door down. I found him inside, and I shot him. And then threw up all over myself. I had been raised never to be violent, and I was completely nonviolent, but in this case, I had to kill a man, and it was a horrible memory for me, which surfaced on that plane as I was flying westward from California.
Now, William Manchester, you were probably a very unlikely Marine because you write of your childhood in Massachusetts, Springfield, I believe, but you were beset on by bullies.
Yes, my father told me never to forget I was a Manchester, which meant fighting back, but my mother, who was from Virginia, taught me always to remember that I was a gentleman. And I simply could not see the sense in inflicting pain on others, and so when I was hit, I turned the other cheek. And I was, as you say, most unlikely Marine.
But you had no sense of pacifism.
Oh, no. And I was not precocious in other ways, but when I reached the age of 10 in 1932, I began reading the New York Times regularly. I was aware of what was happening in Europe and what Hitler was doing, and I wept at the time of Munich because I realized that Hitler had to be stopped, and this would make it that more guilty, that more difficult. And when I joined the Marines after Pearl Harbor, I thought that the Marines would be the first to fight the Germans, which had happened in World War I, and my father was a Marine, and he did that. And you can imagine my chagrin when I wound up on a very sordid, squalid island called Guadalcanal.
We'll get to that in a moment, but first, how did you wind up in the Marines?
Why did I wind up in the Marines?
How did you happen to be in the Marines?
Well, I enlisted.
Mm-hmm.
I enlisted in Springfield, Massachusetts, and I remember the suite of rooms over on the second floor of a shop which commanded a superb view of a Wrigley's chewing gum billboard and the Paramount Theater parking lot.
Now, in Goodbye Darkness, you say that boot camp at Paris Island had a reputation marginally better than Alcatraz and Devil's Island.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if it's much better today than it was back in the early 40s, but how did you react to basic training?
Well, most people detest Paris Island. I, in fact, relished it. I gloried in it.
No.
Yeah, I did. And I understood the basic purpose of boot camp, which is to destroy your personality and then rebuild it in another image. And my father had died a year before, and I was very dissatisfied with my emotional state of mind, and this was a new start for me. And also, by chance, I happened to be although I had never touched a rifle, not even a BB gun, I was a very accurate shot. And on the rifle range at Parris Island, I shot 317 out of a possible 330. And later in the war, this proved to be very useful to me.
You had an incident in which all of you were punished by the feet of one Larry Dudley. Do you remember that?
I sure do. He was a student, college student from Bowdoin, who had spent his summers working at the Springfield Arsenal in Massachusetts as an assistant to John Garand, who invented the M1 rifle. And the first night that we were on Parris Island, the instructor came out, and it was dark. He had the light of a Quonset hut behind him, and he field-stripped the M1 and said, "Let's see you do it," and he handed it to, of all people, Dudley, who could have detail-stripped it blindfold. And with a blur of hands, he managed to field strip it and reassemble it. And the drill instructor was dumbfounded, but then he said, "All right, he can do it. You can all do it. And I want you to be able to do it tomorrow morning when we break you out."
It was a long night, I guess.
It was a long night because lights were out, but we operated under flashlights. And Dudley taught three people, each of whom taught three people more, and we did do it. We were pretty drowsy, but we did do it.
Then at basic training, there was Hunky O'Banion. What happened? What'd he do to you?
I'm sorry, I'm not with you.
Hunky O'Banion. He's the one who challenged you and gave you a bloody nose.
Oh, yes. Well, the problem I have is that I've changed names of these characters to protect their privacy. Yes, this was... It was a stunt, really. Everybody paired off with the fellow recruit or boat, and one would put the butt of his rifle against your forehead, and you slap the button and then you duck, and he was supposed to hit you back. Well, everybody knew that that you were going to change roles, and so you cooperated and you didn't hit him hard or you missed him, assuming that he would do the same. Well, the drill instructors, the DIs, knew this. And so they would pick up a man's rifle and play the part. And one of them had a butt plate against my forehead, and I slapped it, and he hit me square. I was knocked flat. Corporal punishment was not unusual in the Marine Corps at the time. Later, I remember during the war when Patton struck a soldier, and this was considered a terrible thing, but it happened all the time in the Marine Corps, but certainly in boot camp. You were constantly being struck by a fist or an object. It was just part of the training.
Look at Manchester, the image that America had in the 40s, the well-scrubbed young American soldier, mom, apple pie, no profanity. That never happened, did it?
Oh, no. Nobody fought for mom or apple pie. In combat, you fought for your friends, not mom or apple pie or your country or the Marine Corps. You fought for the people who were around you. You depended upon them, and they depended upon you. It is true, however, that we did go willingly to war. Mm-hmm. There was no question about the justice of it. Hitler was evil in Europe, and the Japanese had attacked us at Pearl Harbor, and so we never doubted the need to win the war. And in that sense, we differed a great deal from subsequent generations.
But the image of the American soldier probably wasn't that of the people at home.
Are you talking about the image of the soldier, mm-hmm, or the image of the United States Marine?
Well, I'm sorry. The Marine, I suppose.
There's a difference.
Yes, there is. And you make that clear in your book.
Yeah. Well, the Marine Corps was still an elite outfit. You had to be tall, and you couldn't wear glasses when I enlisted. And generally, the typical Marine was very well muscled. The joke was that the Marine had a size 19 neck and a size 4 hat, and some of them really
were pretty stupid, but they fought well.
You went back to the Philippines, and you saw where the Bataan Death March took place, and you note in your book that there are now signposts that mark that tragedy. What's it like now? What is Bataan like now as it was when you were there during the war?
Well, to begin with, the signposts have been defaced by vandals, which is rather discouraging. Otherwise, Bataan has not changed. For centuries, it's still a very primitive place, in which the inhabitants are unaware not only of the world, they're unaware of the rest of the Philippines or even Luzon. And they live as their ancestors did. And it is these people who were, of course, martyred twice during World War II, in the beginning when the Japanese took Bataan, and then in 1945 when the Americans retook it. And these people were casualties. I think I have always thought of World War II and the Pacific as being a relatively clean war, and that typically there was an island, and there was an American army and a Japanese army, and you fought until one side was wiped out, and there were no civilians. But late in the war, that wasn't true. And on Okinawa, there were 110 Japanese casualties, 60,000 American casualties, but there were 77,000 civilians who died. I wasn't aware of it at the time, but it is true that we had innocent civilians who were sacrificed.
They were caught up in crossfire and artillery fire?
Oh, yes. And the artillery fire was... See, Naha, the capital of Okinawa, was the training school for Japanese artillery, and they had every road junction, every gully zeroed in. And they had tremendous firepower. It was a good deal more like World War I than the rest of World War II. It was static warfare and warfare of attrition.
Corregidor, then and now. Now there's a war memorial there, and in your book you make it relatively clear that you don't care for war memorials.
Oh, on the contrary. I do care about war memorials, but I think they should be decent ones. And what distressed me during my 3-month trip to the battlefields a year and a half ago was that while the Japanese have war memorials everywhere, the Americans do not. And those that exist are defaced or neglected. And on Peleliu, which is an island in the Palau group, which there was fierce fighting by the 1st Marine Division, someone had put up a shaft in 1945 saying, "Lest we forget." And half the letters have fallen off. It's been completely neglected. And it seems to me that the veterans organizations, which are so hot for pensions and other special favors for veterans, ought to pay a little attention to the memorials in the Pacific, because I think it's scandalous.
What is a fitting memorial for the war deck?
Well, it's simply a simple column noting that these men should be remembered.
You were in Corregidor, and you write of a narrow escape that you had. You tripped, and you fell over a communications wire, and that may have saved your life. Do you recall that?
Yes, it was. But that wasn't on Corregidor. That was on Okinawa. Mm-hmm. It's a flash forward in the book, but I was a buck sergeant, and I arrived at the company CP of Fox Company, and there was a patrol about to go off, but the sergeant who would have led it was wounded. So I was ordered to take the patrol out, and 8 men. And we went out, and we found nothing, and we were on our way back when I tripped on a strand of communications wire and fell into a shell hole. And a split second later, a shell landed, which wiped out all the other 8 men. And so I spent the night in the shell hole, and I've spent more pleasant nights.
You write of having hallucinations on the battlefield. This is common.
There are hallucinations of our kind. Probably the commonest one is to look over a distance and see someone whom you know is dead, and he's waving to you, and you go over there, and of course he's not there. My hallucination was that of what I call the horror of death. who was... You see, you have to understand that there has always been a direct relationship between death and lust. Freud is very eloquent on this subject. And in the show, I saw what I thought to be a girl. It was a hallucination. And she was motioning me with various provocative gestures towards Japanese lines. And I don't. It may have been hallucination, it may have been a dream. It was very vivid to me at the time. And when dawn came, I reported back to Fowler, the company commander of Fox Company, and I told him his eight men were dead, and he was sorry to hear that. And then he said to me, were you hurt? And I said, not a scratch. And I believed it.
In the chapter Rim of Darkness, you write of how difficult it is to grasp the nature of the Pacific expanse and the battlefield. Is it so immense, I guess, that it's almost inconceivable that a war is taking place?
Well, you could drop the whole land mass of the world into the Pacific Ocean, and there would be a lot of room left for the seas to roll on, as Melville wrote, as they rolled 4,000 years ago. The distances are extraordinary, and if you superimpose a map of the Pacific on the United States, putting, say, Hawaii at about where New York is, Saipan about where New York is, then Hawaii would lay off the coast of Scotland. It's a tremendous distance. The men who landed on Guam had been aboard ship for 59 days. And when you consider the implications of that, their muscles had atrophied. They had no exercise, and they were expected to hit the beach in fighting trim. And, of course, they weren't. It was the distance of the Pacific are, I think, a mystery to most people. Very few people could put their finger on a map within 1,000 miles of Guadalcanal. They think of Singapore as a Chinese city. They think of Iwo Jima as being in the South Pacific, when it's at 1,500 miles above the equator. They're baffled, and I think this is true of a great many people who fought out there. They have no idea where they were.
Jungle fighting. You write that in New Guinea it took 17 hours for one battalion just to hack about a third of a mile all the way through the jungle.
Yeah.
But the Japanese, you also say, believe that no terrain was impassable. Did we have a lot of trouble with the terrain as compared to the Japanese?
Well, I think that we were fighting not only the Japanese, but also the jungle. And sometimes the jungle was the more difficult adversary. And Cape Gloucester, for example, where the 1st Marine Division went after Guadalcanal, there were over 100 men killed by huge falling trees. And I've always wondered on how their parents were notified. How do you say, not your son wasn't killed in action, but your son was killed by a huge falling tree? And I don't know how they were answered. But at times, the two armies were groping toward one another, trying to find one another to fight. And the jungle intervened. And there were sea battles which were broken off because neither side knew where the bottom was. They were operating with 17th century charts, highly unreliable. The evil and horror and beauty of the jungle defies explanation, but it is tremendously powerful and it leaves its mark upon you.
When in Manchester, the Japanese, a very special enemy, right? A much different enemy perhaps than America had ever confronted before. What were they like?
We are forbidden to use certain languages, I trust, certain language I trust in this program. The Japanese did not believe in surrender. As a matter of fact, they felt that this would bring dishonor not only upon themselves, but upon their families and their ancestors. The noblest thing that could happen was for them to die for the emperor. And so the only prisoners that were taken were Japanese who were stunned, perhaps by shell fire. and could not kill themselves. But this meant that there was a war on which quarter was neither asked nor given. Each battle was fought out until one side had lost everyone. And they were a very clever and indeed heroic people. The crossing of the Owen Stanley Range in New Guinea is an example of that. And they could be defeated only by men who matched that heroism. As in Australia, the Australians and the GIs did, and then in the Solomons and elsewhere, the Marine Corps.
I get the impression you don't like the Japanese. You certainly didn't like them when they were your enemy.
Oh, I think it's more complicated than that. I like young Japanese very much, those who have no recollection of those years. The same is true in Germany. I spent many years in Germany researching The Arms of Krupp, a book about the German munitions dynasty. And with German college students, relations were splendid. I do have a difficulty with Japanese and with Germans who are my age, because there is ever a wall between us. I remember on the canal I talked to a Captain Honda who had volunteered for the Kamikaze Corps in 1945 and had been turned down. And I congratulated him upon his failure to pass the examination. He gave me the coldest, thinnest smile I've ever seen, and I realized there was a wall between this man, which would always separate us.
You like the Australians?
Oh, yes. I think everybody likes the Australians. They're wonderful people.
And they were good to fight with.
They were very good fighters. And they were, you see, after Pearl Harbor, at the time of Pearl Harbor, immediately before it, everyone knew the Japanese were going to strike, but no one knew where. And so there was a debate, would it be in Hawaii, or in the Philippines, or Hong Kong, Malaya, and Thailand? No one realized the Japanese were planning to strike all these places simultaneously. And they did, and in a matter of 6 months, they had achieved gains unmatched in the history of warfare. And Australia was threatened with invasion. And this is why MacArthur was recalled from the Philippines to Australia to organize the resistance. Well, the Australians had no troops. They had three divisions fighting in the Middle East under Montgomery. And it took a lot of arm twisting before Churchill agreed to return those three divisions. And they did come back, and they stopped the Japanese in New Guinea. Simultaneously, the Marines landed on Guadalcanal, and the tide had really turned.
There were a lot of little things that made life hard. For example, you write about uniforms that were not really designed for jungle fighting and tropical fighting.
Oh, yeah. Well, the most conspicuous example of that was on Tarawa. On Tarawa, the 2nd Marine Division was issued camouflage uniforms, but unfortunately, they were not porous. And there was no way for air to seep through, and consequently, everybody at Tarawa sweated a great deal, and combat is uncomfortable enough as it is. This added to the burden.
Then there was an incident about the American war dead, and a debate, I guess, in the higher levels of the military as to whether or not to release to the American public photographs of the American war dead.
Those were photographs taken at Tarawa, or in Basio, which is an island in the atoll where the fighting occurred. And they were simply photographs of fallen Marines face down on the beach. And those were released at home, and there was an uproar. People were very distressed. And we didn't see the point of that, because to us, a man who fell and was face down in the sand, he died a clean death. And there was none of the dismemberment and the real gore and horror of the war, which, in New Guinea, for example, there was a Jap corpse whose hand was sticking out of a trench, and each Australian who went by shook the hand. And there were, on Iwo Jima and Okinawa, there were barricades of bodies laced up in ponchos and communications wire, like cordwood. And at Buna, the Japanese actually used the bodies that way and wore gas masks to fight off the stench. The horrors of war are truly horrible. And the pictures of dead Marines in Tarawa didn't distress us at all, and we were puzzled why the people at home were upset.
These horrors have never really ended for you, have they? Do you carry them with you, perhaps, for the rest of your life?
I suppose that's true of all of us, though. I think that the 3-month trip I took in the fall of 78 resolved a lot of problems for me. I could see the thing more clearly.
In what way?
I was wounded on Okinawa, a superficial gunshot wound, on June the 2nd, 1945. It was what we call the million-dollar wound. It offered me an honorable exit from the war. I could be warm and dry and safe in a hospital, and I was. And the following day, I heard that my outfit was going to make a landing behind Japanese lines, and I jumped hospital to rejoin the regiment. And that puzzled me, because I was not a heroic figure at all. I was more terrier than lion. And if there was a comfortable hole, I hid in it. So why did I go back? Well, it wasn't until I actually returned to Okinawa and was standing on the top of Sugarloaf Hill, where over 7,500 Marines fell, and I realized that it was for comradeship because of my devotion to men who had saved my life. And this is difficult to imagine for people from the Vietnam War era, how we felt about that and how, and the sort of thing we did. On Okinawa, my regiment suffered 81% casualties. The key to the island defenses was Sugarloaf Hill. On Okinawa, my regiment suffered 81% casualties. But on the evening of May the 19th, 1945, as darkness fell down upon the embattled armies, the 29th Marines held Sugarloaf Hill, and in a sense, the 29th Marines hold it still.
We're almost out of time, but William Manchester, you write that those who fought in the Pacific believe that they would be remembered forever, that the school children would be told of their sacrifices and of their greatest battles. Has this happened?
No, it has not, but that doesn't mean that it will not. There's a certain interregnum after every great war. That was true of the American Civil War. It wasn't really until the 1880s or 1890s that the memorial started going up. And, of course, since then, we have had dreadful experiences with war in Korea and Vietnam. And there are debates over whether these wars are justified. There has never been a debate about World War II on the fact that we were fighting a just war. And I honestly do not think that I could have fought in Vietnam